Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning, we're happy to have back on the program Kevin Waspe. He's a lecturer in the Department of Finance in the College of Business here at the U of I, and is here sitting in for David Sinnoh, who for a long time has been doing the show with us on a regular basis to talk about personal finance and money management. Dave's away this month, but when Dave is not here, Kevin is the guy who fills in, and it's always good. We appreciate his being here and coming over to spend some time with us, talk about some of the same kinds of things, maybe with slightly different sort of spin than Dave has. But it's the same kind of show. The idea is the same as always, that if you have questions about your own personal finance issues, now, whatever that would be and whatever point in your life you are, whether you're one of those people that's just trying to get started and not really quite sure what to do with your money, or you're close to retirement or you're in retirement and you need to guard your assets very carefully, you have any of those kinds of questions about financial planning and money management, call in and give us as much information as you can, and Kevin will do his best to help you out. Certainly, he'll give you his opinion. He'll take your best shot, 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. So at any point here, you got questions, you give us a call. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, David. I always enjoy being here with you.
Here now, we're at a point where, you know, we know the economy goes up and down, but we're in a pretty serious down right at the moment. It seems like we have maybe one of the worst, maybe the worst real estate market in living memory, practically, or at least over the past several decades. Very high cost for energy, oil particularly, that affects the cost of everything. Certainly, there's been a lot of contraction all over the place. And I expect that probably one of the things that people are wondering is, well, you know, is this just a down and we have ups and downs? Or is there some way that the place that we are now might actually be a more significant kind of turning point, and that that would mean that from this point forward, things would be different? Any way to say that? To answer a question like that when you're in the middle of that, or, you know, does it have to
sure.
be when you're looking back?
That's an absolutely fabulous question. And before I even venture any thoughts on it, you know, if any one of us could predict the future, boy, it would be a whole different ballgame. So I would just say that anything I would espouse would be certainly what I would like to refer to as an educated guess, and I'll emphasize the guess part and hope for the education part. But let's go right to the heart of the question. In the short run, I think things are still very much the jury is out. In other words, there are those forces you mentioned, the pullback in real estate prices, the exuberance in those markets that 3 or 4 years ago, you know, people were just seeing values of land, values of buildings just grow at unsustainable levels, a little bit like the dot-com boom in the stock market of the 1990s. Now, it's difficult to say when that's happening, you know, that, gee, I know it can't go on forever, but I'm just not able to say how long it can go on. But in perspective, we saw an unsustainable rise in real estate values. And part of that is pretty easy to see why in hindsight. So taking that as the negative, the biggest negative, let's put it that way, in addition with the rising price of energy, you might say that things are pretty weak right now, and the potential in the short run is to slip into the dreaded R word, recession. Now, this recession has been much discussed, but little in appearance. So at least to date, the jury is still out on that. I'd like to back up to a much longer term perspective, though, and think back over the past 30 years. And 30 years is short in a sense of an evolution of an economy, an evolution of financial markets. It's a really short-term period, but I think in that period, we get a little bit more perspective. So here's the thoughts I would venture with. We saw a tremendous growth in personal wealth in this country and many developed nations over the past 30 years. and it pretty much fit the demographic of our society. We had more people in the baby boomer generation coming into some of the highest earning years of their lives. And now, you know, that's about to turn over. So those huge multitude of people, the baby boom generation, have now peaked, for the most part, in their earnings potential. And as they move on into retirement, their earnings potential will only be sustained by beginning to withdraw some of those assets they've put away in retirement use. In looking at it in that sense and seeing all of the consumer spending that's occurred over the past 30 years with that big baby boomer generation just, you know, continually moving higher on the ladder of success, I see a little bit darker picture for the coming 10, maybe 15 years. And that is one where I don't think we'll see again each generation believing and seeing the proof of their offspring living a higher standard of living. I think that's over. I don't see a return to asset prices rising dramatically and for long periods of time, whether it's real estate or stocks or whatever. Because I think what we're seeing is a shifting, maybe even a passing of the baton. The developed nations, the U.S., Germany, France, Britain, we're passing the baton to the next successor countries of industrial leadership. So you've heard the acronym BRIC, the Brazil, Russia, India, China type of growth areas. That's not a bad thing, but it's something that we need to be cognizant of. We can prosper during this passing of the baton if we plan for it wisely. But to resume the kind of levels of success and the levels of growth that we saw over the past 30 years, I think is rather foolhardy to think that we could return to that.
People, I'm sure, are still going to buy homes. They're still going to have a place to live. So that's not something that has changed. Now, it may well be that the big change, as you say, is that maybe there won't be the same kind of investment component to your primary residence that you have seen in the past, because the values just aren't going to go up. You're not going to be able to buy it at, you know, X dollars and then 10, 15 years later sell it at X plus dollars. But people are still going to need places to live. And I assume that, you know, maybe there'll be some small growth in value, much smaller than we've seen. So having said all that, I mean, does that, do you think that that's going to lead people to think any differently about this, what is for a lot of people maybe the biggest thing that they, one of the biggest things that they buy ever, and for a lot of people, it's still going to be their major asset? I mean, do you think people are going to think any differently about that really than they ever have?
Well, there's nothing wrong with thinking about the roof over your head as one of the major assets in your portfolio. But I think over the past 10, maybe even 15 years, we began to look at that as an ATM machine. Okay? So with the dramatic rise in appraised values of real estate, we were able to increase our standard of living by borrowing against that growing value. That's the part that's over. I'm not saying that we shouldn't own a house, and I'm not saying that people won't continue to want to own their own houses. That will still make good sense. But I would point, again, back to the demographics. I think fewer people will be in the housing market because the baby boomers have their house. And with a lesser number of people in our population coming in to replace them, or to grow our population at a fast enough rate to make up for their eventual passing, that I don't see happening. So for the people coming up in life, my son, many listeners, sons or daughters, regardless of age, they'll come into those ownership of asset years. But there will be fewer of them than in my generation. and they will no longer be able to look at those as an ATM machine that they can continually fund a rising lifestyle.
One of the things that I think that a lot of people, maybe if they've had this experience, when you go to, when you buy a home, you got it picked out, you go to get your financing, you go down to the bank, you have this conversation where you provide them with your basic financial information, and then they turn around and tell you what they think you can afford. And I have had this experience, maybe other people have had, that the people at the bank say, well, you can afford this kind of monthly mortgage payment. You look at it and think, are you nuts? I'm not going to do that's way too much. I'm not going to commit to putting out that much of my monthly income on the mortgage, even if you tell me that you think that I can. You know, you don't want to be house poor. And I wonder if as far as the, you know, what, and particularly the whole credit crunch and the subprime mortgage deal is going to do to lenders, and whether in fact already we've seen lenders be much more conservative about what it is that they are willing to lend and what they're going to tell people about what they think they can afford.
Right. A lot of your surprise at what you were told, what size house you could afford, a lot of that over the past 5 to 7 years was really thrown out the window. Mm-hmm. A reaction similar to yours was the exception, not the rule. When people were told, well, you can afford this cost of house, the response instead was, are you sure I couldn't afford a little more? And the actions that were taken on both sides were rather foolish. Again, a lot of this becomes really clear in hindsight, but I'll take you back to January of 2007. And there was a great article in the Wall Street Journal on the first page of the C section, Money and Investing. And the title goes something like, Money, Money Everywhere, But For How Long? It went on, it talked about not only mortgage loans for consumers, but also corporate loans and the terms that were used to describe the covenants, the deals, the contract. Were very commonly generating into what was called covenant-lite deals. Covenant-lite means you don't have to maintain the same debt-to-equity ratios. You don't have to maintain the same interest coverage ratios. So again, whether it's, you know, we use this term subprime, but that's really just a tip of a very large iceberg. We moved through a period in our economy for 5 to 7 years where money was way too prevalent, way too cheap, and the conditions to borrow it were way too easy. In a lot of ways, lenders made drunken sailors look like saints. And this is part of a credit cycle. This happens about every 30 years, and we have to learn it all over again. It seems like each generation of lenders and borrowers has to kind of learn that the hard way.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Kevin Wasby. He's a lecturer in the Department of Finance in the College of Business here at University of Illinois. He's sitting in for David Sinnoh this month, and this is our regular monthly program on personal finance. And the idea is if you have questions about your own financial situation, you're not exactly sure what to do, you can call in and take advantage of his experience and tell us the situation and ask your questions, and he'll tell you what he thinks. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. Well, let me ask you something else a little bit different, and it was prompted, the questions prompted by some of the things that you said about the strength of other economies around the world as compared to that of the United States. And the solid belief that I think a lot of people have that particularly economies like that of China and India and other countries as well are certainly growing, and we expect them to grow even more dramatically so that in the future they will certainly be very, very big and very powerful economies. So now when you think about investing, I think in the past that people thought, you know, probably it was a good idea maybe to have some international exposure as a balance And some people also made the argument, I'm not sure it's quite so true anymore, but some people also made the argument, said when we're up, they're down. When they're down, we're up. So it's also a way to balance out the volatility. Now, do you think that it is, if indeed you can diversify that to that extent, do you think now that it is more important than it has been in the past to think about, if you're going to be investing in stocks, and probably most people will do that through mutual fund, to put some money into the international?
Yes. I think exposure to investment in markets outside of the United States and into developing areas is a necessity. I think you brought up an interesting point, though. In the past, that was always something brought up in the notion of diversification. And as you pointed out, even as a counterbalance, you know, when they're down, we're up, and vice versa. I think the correlations have gotten much more positive. In other words, it's not a case anymore where we're up, we're down, they're down, or vice versa. I think one of the myths that we've dispelled over the past year is a word that was used quite popularly a few years ago, and that is, given this base of growth in India, in China, even Russia, that the world's economies had decoupled. And I always laughed when I heard that word. I never bought that belief. I think there might be three or four people left that believe that world economies have decoupled. But I think if anything, we've learned from this process of becoming a more unified global society and a more unified global economy is that our economies are more strongly linked now than perhaps they ever have been. Mm-hmm. So again, I do believe in exposure to these developing markets, small. I do, on the other hand, caution a person, do not expect them to be a counterbalance as they may have been 15 or 20 years ago. I think the linkages are stronger now and will probably grow stronger.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you were going to do that, then is this a matter of can you do this broadly? That is to say, you know, put your money in one fund that will be broadly invested and say big companies across a number of regions, or is this a matter that you look at a fund and it might be European, and then you look at another fund and that might be East Asian or South Asian, and then if you really want to get complete exposure, you may have to go into more than one fund?
Yeah, that's a great question. Some of that depends upon a person's risk tolerance. Some of it depends upon their investable wealth. The larger the sum of money, the more opportunity there might be to have specialty type of exposures. And again, we'd both agree that this would be through mutual funds or exchange traded funds, the kind of stock clones of mutual funds. But what I'm saying is, with a greater amount of money, you might have a greater opportunity to look at specialty type of opportunities, whether they're ETFs or mutual funds. I think that also requires not only money, it takes risk tolerance. A more prudent way, let's say a less concentrated way, and a way that can be done with fewer dollars, would be to look at a decent global fund where you have an exposure outside of the United States to areas not just China, not just India, not just Germany, but literally Canada, Australia, countries that we don't think of as being alternative investment areas when we think of developing or growth nations, but in some sense are, because they may be very resource intensive. Australia, for example, has benefited handsomely in trade with China, with all of Asia, India. And it's predominantly because it's a very resource-rich country. So there are opportunities as tangents to the growth in China, to the growth across Asia, that don't have to center in Asia.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that certainly we've talked about with Dave, and I'm sure that other investment advisors would remind people, is if you're trying to develop a kind of a if you have the money to invest and you're going to be someone who's investing in mutual funds, then what you want to do is, again, have a sort of a broad kind of exposure. So someone might say, well, I'm going to put my money into a fund that is essentially an S&P 500 kind of fund, which means that the money is going into a big basket of stocks of the biggest companies.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that I think investment advisors will say is you also have to consider the fact that it's weighted. It's not evenly distributed. It's mm-hmm. really weighted towards big companies. So if what you want to do is say, I want to put my money broadly into not just the big companies, but also some medium-sized companies and some smaller companies. Well, if you're going to do that, then really what you got to do is you got to have three funds. Maybe you want to be in the S&P 500 fund, but then you want a fund that invests in sort of middle-sized companies mm-hmm. and one that invests in small-sized companies. And that way you're really, truly spreading your money out from the bigger companies to the smaller companies. So having said all that, again, to the extent that you could do it, you could go into a global fund. You could just be in one fund. If you want to make things simple, you could say, okay, I want to put half my money into an S&P 500 fund and half into a big global fund and just, you know, so that way I will sleep at night and I'm not going to worry about this. but if you do want to invest internationally and you do want to have that same kind of spread and diversification, I mean, how exactly, if you're not going to go by region, can you do that other thing that says, well, I'm willing to take some risk and I want to invest in some companies. Maybe they're small companies today, but looks like they're aggressive and looks like they have real potential for growth. I mean, can you do that like an international growth fund?
Oh, yes. The one thing that's very true about mutual funds and within the past 3 to 4 years, exchange traded funds, is there are at least three funds for every purpose. I mean, there are so many of them that it's really gotten, I think, silly to an extent to see how many different ways there are to do the same thing. You've pointed out something that's really fundamental and really, really good. And that is, think about where you'd like to see your money in the long term. As long as you have a risk tolerance that permits maybe even month to month or year to year pullbacks, decline in value, losses. Let's just use the ugly word. If that's something that still is comfortable to you, then having exposure to not only different areas of the world, but different sizes of companies makes good sense. Mm-hmm. The confusion comes not so much in which ones to choose, but I think it's still true that asset allocation will determine the majority of the results of returns, not which securities, or maybe not even which funds within those classifications. Mm-hmm. So that's the good news.
Okay, we have a caller here. Welcome, others. We're about at our midpoint here. Our guest is Kevin Waspy. He's a lecturer in the Department of Finance in the College of Business at the U of I. This is our monthly show on personal finance. David Sinnoh, the guy who's been doing it for a long time, is away this month, and Kevin has stepped in to be the special guest this time around. And if you have questions, you can give us a call. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, I don't know, maybe a few years back or so that they were talking about in terms of the stock market in terms of being as robust. I mean, some of these growths, you know, 8, 10, 15, you know, percent or so, do you see that, you know, in other words, modifying to a certain degree or not? Or is this still going to go on?
In stock markets across the world or in our stock market? Or
yeah, particularly in our stock market. I mean, what happens is that, you know, you saw these huge increase and the pressure with the stockholders to say, well, we want to do better and better and all that kind of thing. Do you think that, it just seemed to me that sometimes it didn't seem reasonable.
I agree with you. I didn't think it seemed reasonable at the time. If there's any way you'd want to convince yourself that that's something that's probably not too probable, build yourself a simple little Excel spreadsheet. I don't care what amount of money you start with, but compound over any length of time a 15% annual rate of growth.
Mm-hmm.
The numbers get real big real fast. And again, to me, it just kind of points out that that's something that you just can't do. Now, when I say can't do, you can't do it for any length of time. I'm a big believer in regressing to the mean. I think, in terms of looking down the road with what I think is a very mature economy of the United States, the demographic overlay that I mentioned earlier, if I could see long-term 9% returns in the stock market, I'd be happy as a clam. Again, for the same reasons, build yourself a spreadsheet and compound 9% annually. It's healthy.
Mm-hmm.
But double digits, no way. We had that period, excuse me, we had that period, in the 1990s. That was a decade that was almost unparalleled in our history. We had those kinds of returns that were just eye-popping year after year. We got into the early 2000s. That was upset rather abruptly. We gave back a little bit of those returns, but again, in a belief of regressing to the mean, I think we're still headed back into a slower growth and slower rate of return than recent phenomenon.
But even if you look at the performance of stock over maybe a period of 10 years or 15 or 20 or whatever, I mean, the average with the ups and the downs, I mean, the average was about, 8%? 6 or 7, depends on what category of stock that you were in, right?
Yeah, I mean, you can pick any 10-year period you'd like if you don't want to cherry-pick the numbers. But,
right.
if we went back to, let's just say, the year that most people use for a beginning point, because it's a base year for the Standard & Poor's 500. So 1926, I mean, if we were to go back and look at nominal rates of return on large U.S. stocks, you'd call it around 11%.
Mm.
Now, that's nominal.
Mm-hmm.
And it does include things like the Depression, the crash of 29, the bottoming of the stock market in 1933. But it also includes those periods where you've got tremendous returns after World War II that built this economy into, we were the manufacturers for the world.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was our salad days. And then we got a second glance of that with the technological revolution that happened in the late 80s and out through the 90s. The nice thing about technology is it allows us to bring our work wherever we go. So why is anybody surprised that the 1990s we saw strong growth in the economy, we saw strong growth in personal wealth, in lifestyles, we saw super strong growth in productivity? It occurred during a time when inflation was almost non-existent, and I mean, it shouldn't be surprising. We basically took our work 24/7. But you can only get so much efficiency there. You see, I can't find the 25th hour in the day. So that's done. We're over. The rest of the internet is entertainment from this point forward.
The other one that you brought it up, and certainly my concern, is inflation. What do you think is going to happen there?
I don't like the current state of affairs. And for the past, I would say, year, I've been referring to our central bank, the Federal Reserve, as Fed in a box. They would love to raise interest rates to show that they're going to send a strong signal about containing the price rises we've seen in energy, in food, and have begun to leak into other areas. but they're in a box because they can't, given the weakness in the credit markets. So, you know, in the moment to moment, yeah, they've talked tough. Chairman Bernanke was out 2 weeks ago talking up the dollar. 2 days later, the European Central Banker came out and said, well, we're going to raise interest rates in July. And everybody thought, you know, sort of like, what are you two fighting for? In measuring a rate of inflation, there's the official way to do it, and then there's the your pocket, my pocket way to do it.
Mm.
Now, the reported measures of an inflation have shown some people some concern, but those numbers are still puny compared to the your pocket, my pocket impact. I don't know about you, but I just paid my real estate taxes, and despite everything I read about house prices going down, I paid more. And the last time I put gas in the car, I paid more. And the last time I bought a box of cereal, I paid more. So in the process of measuring that inflation, I really like looking at currencies. And when I can see the rate of exchange a dollar has between whether it's a euro, a Japanese yen, or anything else, that gives me a better understanding of what I think people's impressions and what maybe even their inferences of future rates of inflation are. And that's a bad signal.
All right. Well, I appreciate the caller with his comments. Let's go and talk to somebody else. This is someone in Danvers, and it's line 4, our toll-free line. Hello.
Well, you just began to touch on the question I had, which was whether you had any thoughts or information about the viability of our banking system, in that some commentators are predicting a collapse of the banking system, that banks all over the world are printing money to, governments all over the world are printing money to prop up these banks, which would lead to what you were talking about, inflation. Do you have any information about that?
I could point you to countless numbers of places where you could read different people's opinions. Let's kind of address it this way. Global credit went through a tremendous binge period. Again, over the past 7 years, literally, people were paid to borrow money. And what I mean is, interest rates were at such a low level in a nominal sense that with any measurable inflation at all, real interest rates were zero or perhaps even negative. And that was true not only in the United States, but through much of the world. We have to work through those excesses. I don't think the banking system in this country or other developed countries is going to collapse. That's not a fear I have. I do have a belief that we're seeing some of the inflationary results of that excess of money in the system. It'll be a while to work its way through. It'll be rather chaotic. Some banks will fail. Perhaps some countries will repudiate or fail on their debt. We've been this route before. I think we can get through it again. But to believe that everything's fine, and as Larry Kudlow would tell you, Goldilocks is alive and well, I don't buy that.
Does that get your question, or you want to follow up?
Well, that's very interesting. One sort of related question regarding Social Security. Some people have charged that government bureaucracies are holding down the COLAs, the cost of living increases that apply to Social Security, when inflation is actually, they're saying, closer to 10% instead of 3%. And one way of managing Social Security is to keep the COLAs down and pay Social Security with cheaper inflated dollars.
Yeah, I've heard that too. I'm not a real big fan of conspiracy theory beliefs, and I'm a lesser fan of believing that our government has the intelligence to be able to do that. I really don't think they're capable of scheming that. I just place a very low opinion on the economic creativity of our government. So let me back off from that personal opinion and just basically say it this way. There are a lot of things they've already done that basically keep Social Security in a terrible state of affairs as it is right now. One of the things that they do is they account for those liabilities basically off the balance sheet of the United States government, which I think is a travesty. If they wanted, if they wanted to do anything as clandestine, as secretive, as try to manage a reported inflation number a little bit lower, so not as to impact the COLAs. The COLAs, in the bigger picture of things, are a small problem to deal with. The bigger problem is the demographics I just mentioned earlier. You're going to have, I mean, this is not guesswork. You're going to have a time where more people are drawing than ever before and fewer people contributing than ever before. And when that comes to happen in a pension system, whether it's Social Security or a private pension, that's just a real bad mix.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Next, we'll talk to somebody in Belgium. Line number two. Hello.
Yes. Earlier in your discussion, you were talking about how we've gone through various types of technological changes that have made the economy grow very rapidly. And it seems that there's a scream being yelled into our ears right now that we're at the verge of a technological change that we all have to get on board, and that is we've got to change from a carbon-based fuel. Now, I understand petroleum companies want to get every dime out of it they're going to get, and they are going to also turn that monies that they get towards alternative energies. But isn't this an area where each and every individual person can get involved with this and possibly all of us do a lot better?
Well, if you're asking me, can we each conserve energy in our own way, my answer is absolutely yes.
And since that's such an awfully expensive aspect of our livelihood now, going every place from how we want to go, how we heat our houses, how we get our food, how we conduct our entire lifestyle, it's money well spent. It's an effort well spent.
Well, I think it's a tremendous investment with a huge return. I agree 100%. But I would have to say that, you know, on the other hand, you need to re-educate people, and that's a slow process. The market price of energy is the strongest educator out there. And for anyone to say, well, I think we ought to suspend the federal tax on gasoline, or I think we ought to do this to lower the price of crude oil or so on, I think those are really bad policies. Now, as much as I hate to pay what I'm paying for energy, whether it's gasoline, natural gas, electricity, you name it, that is a market discipline that will eventually bring people to adjust their habits of consumption. When people told me that I should leave my PC on in my office 24/7, I looked at them, and this was 15 years ago, and I looked at them and said, no, that's baloney. Well, you know, it works more efficiently that way. Well, I'm not working. It doesn't need to. Now, if it's a server behind, you know, a relay station that's serving up web pages throughout the world or acting as a relay in the internet itself, 24/7 happens. I understand that. but my PC does not run unless I'm at my desk using it. I mean, when I leave the office, I turn it off. And, you know, I'm amazed at how few people leave a room and turn the lights off. But that's just me. I'm cheap.
Well, I have to agree with you, sir, 100%. But the thing I'm speaking about also, sir, is the fact that we need to move to a new technology. And as I've spoken on Mr. Inge's show many, many times, hydrogen is a way we want to go. And we need to put a lot of effort in that way.
We
could sell that technology all over the world.
I agree that alternatives are necessary. I don't think any one alternative will ever replace in our lifetimes the single beauty of liquid carbon-based energy. I mean, think of the magic that stuff does for us. Could you imagine flying a 747 on hydrogen?
I'm not sure that we need to be in that part of the atmosphere polluting it, but that's another topic altogether, sir.
Well, if you could tell a person not to fly to Tokyo, that's fine.
Yes. We can take a boat. We can take a boat.
Well, then can you imagine hydrogen pushing that ocean liner?
As a matter of fact, I could.
I'd love to see the storage tanks for it.
Well, you can convert to energy as you go along. We can always do that. More innovative ways of thinking of the problems, what I'm trying to say.
I understand, and science is promising. I believe we'll get there someday. I just don't think we can force the technology to make it happen. If somebody comes up with cold fusion tomorrow, I'm all for it. But I think Pons and Fleischmann were, debunked a few years ago.
I'm going to jump in here. I appreciate the comments of the caller. We just have about 5 minutes left. To get into something completely different, we had a caller, a question here come in off the air that I think might be worth talking a little bit about, particularly for people who might be listening who work for the university. People here in the university, we have the opportunity to save for our retirement by putting money into something called a 403B, which is essentially it's a 401K. It's just got a different number, and it's for people who work in education. So essentially it's the same kind of thing that you can choose among a number of mutual funds. There are a number of ways you can go. Here, though, the caller was wondering about, now there are two options here. There is a traditional 403B where you're putting in pre-tax money. And now I think fairly recently there is also a Roth option and where you're putting in post-tax money. And I think that the caller was just interested in having you talk a little bit about what are the relative advantages and why might someone want to do one as opposed to the other.
Sure, that's a great question. And you're absolutely right. The Roth feature is a recent addition. It is similar to the Roth IRAs that have been out since 1996, I want to say, 97. Don't quote me on that. But basically, money that goes into those arrangements is after-tax money, meaning that you have no tax advantage in the year of contribution. But under certain conditions, when it comes out, the money that comes out and the earnings also come out without income tax implications. I'm a strong believer in Roth IRAs. I have one, and I like them. I like to have the Roth IRA, though. I'm not a big fan of the Roth 403B. Now, that's for me, because I don't make a lot of money. If I made a little bit more money, then I'd try to fund both the Roth 403B and the traditional or the tax-advantaged 403B. I can tell you that from the time I came back to the university from industry, I have put the maximum amount that you're allowed to put into the university's 403B plan. Again, I'm cheap. I'm a tightwad. I like to save. I realize that in the future, when those monies come out, I'll have to pay income tax on that and the earnings. But I guess I believe that, like death, taxes are things we really can't escape. I think there's an opportunity for people with higher incomes than I have to be able to run a good balance between the Roth 403B and the traditional or pre-tax 403B aspect. For myself, I max out on the 403B that is the tax-advantaged, traditional, if you want to call it, and also put money into my Roth IRA.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that there are that many different options for what you can do with the money if you want to set up a Roth. You can go down to your local bank, and you can just say, I want to set up a Roth, and they'll say, that's fine. And they'd be very happy for you to take that money and put it into CDs, which would probably be the easiest thing, you know, and depending on how long you want to go, the only decisions you have to make is what's going to be the term of your CDs, and then what's in there stays there until you get to the point where you can pull that out. What do you think about if you're going to set up a Roth, a traditional Roth IRA, where you want to put that money?
Well, again, I think with a person that has a long horizon, they need exposure to things that grow over time rather than preserve principal. Savings accounts are wonderful things. CDs are terrific things. But they're savings vehicles, meaning they're meant to preserve principal. They're meant to have very little or no risk. And they're meant to give you a commensurate rate of return. To have a long-term perspective, you need exposure to things that grow, that do vacillate in value, and that give you the opportunity for higher rates of return. Stocks, alternative investments like real estate, the proxies for them, things like mutual funds and the exchange-traded funds, those are all things that should be done. So your local bank probably has a capacity for an IRA to invest in funds. Mm-hmm. Now, it may be a little subdivision of the bank. It is a little corner of the U of I Employees Credit Union because those institutions are not allowed to directly sell you things that are of risky asset nature. But through a subsidiary, they have a broker-dealer in their facility that can help you out. Again, there are self-managed opportunities too. So whether it's a Fidelity or a Vanguard, one of the large fund companies, they'll set up those types of funds too.
Okay. We're down to the point we have just a couple of minutes left. I don't know if there's anything in particular, any thoughts you'd like to leave with folks. It's not the kind of things we've been talking about here all along, particularly the beginning. It's not the best time, maybe not the worst, but, you know, what would you encourage people to be thinking about at a time like this?
I think this is a great time to be reminded of the fundamentals. Some of those fundamentals we've talked about. You can't expect something to produce a rate of return that's just eye-popping for any length of time. And if it does, you shouldn't be surprised that you get a rather chaotic reversal or reversion to the mean. I think the lessons that we've seen ought to remind us that over the long run, prudence is rewarded. So don't have a huge part of your income committed to a fixed asset, your house, or whatever, that you think is going to be the winner. It's the old adage, don't put all your eggs in one basket, and don't be greedy. Bulls make a little, bears make a little, hogs get slaughtered.
And if, just as a practical matter, you're trying to save, you want to get a good return on that, you want to try and interest rates now on savings are not very good, but if you want to put that money into something that where you can get a reasonable rate of return, it's going to be safe, and it's going to be in a place where if you really need the money, it's not going to be a problem to mm-hmm. get it. What really is the best choice, or are there in fact that many choices?
Well, I guess I'd defer to the overriding, and the overriding is, at least what I heard in your prescription, you want a safety of principal, and you want accessibility. So I'll look at things, even though the yields are unattractive. I'll look at things like certificates of deposit at the credit union, at the bank. And I would structure them in a ladder of maturities. which is to say, take the sum of money that you're going to put in them, carve it up into four equal pieces, go 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, and 24 months with each quarter. And that ladder of maturity gives you an every 6 month opportunity to access a quarter of your money. It gives you, if you have no need for it, the opportunity to go out and reinvest at a 24 month rate and reset the ladder all over again. It's a simple strategy. It pays dividends whether interest rates are low and rising, as they may be. It pays dividends if interest rates are stable. And it pays dividends even if interest rates decline a little bit. Will it make you rich? Absolutely not. It's not the goal. The goal was to protect your principal. The goal was to give you some ability of access in need. And the goal was to pay you a rate of return commensurate with that risk. And I think that accomplishes it.
All right. For now, we'll have to leave it there with the promise that again next month we'll do this again. It's something we do each month on the program. Here our guest is Kevin Wasby. He's a lecturer in the Department of Finance in the College of Business at the U of I, sitting in this month for David Sinnoh. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, David. Always a pleasure, and apologize for my scratchy voice.